Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week we're going to be taking a look at the kind of forgotten, for the moment, I believe, 1989 James Cameron epic, The Abyss. And The Abyss hasn't even been mastered to Blu-ray yet, which is really interesting. So I had to kind of roust around for an upscaled copy of it because, The Abyss is definitely due for a little resurgence. And I think it's kind of a lost, really great film that people don't talk about enough. So anyway, we will get to that as we go. First, let's do a little background on The Abyss. The idea for The Abyss came to Cameron when he was 17 and in high school, supposedly attended a science lecture about deep sea diving given by a man named Francis Afologisic, who was the first human being to breathe fluid through his lungs in experiments conducted by a guy named Johannes Kilstra. He subsequently wrote a short story, Cameron did, that focused on a group of scientists in a lab at the bottom of the ocean. So the basic idea didn't change, but many of the details evolved over the years, and once Cameron arrived in Hollywood, he quickly realized that a group of scientists was not that commercial and changed it to a group of blue-collar workers. While making Aliens, Cameron saw a National Geographic film about remote-operated vehicles operating deep in the North Atlantic. These images reminded him of his short story, and he and producer Gail Ann Hurd decided that The Abyss would be their next film. Cameron wrote a treatment combined with elements of a shooting script, which generated a lot of interest in Hollywood. He then wrote the script basing the character of Lindsay on Hurd and finished it by the end of 1987. Cameron and Hurd were married before The Abyss, separated during pre-production, and divorced in February 1989, 2 months after principal photography. And as I'll get to a little bit in the trivia, this film's production was really, really reviled by a lot of the people who were involved in it. That this was really probably one of Cameron's toughest productions, and everyone who was on the film as well. But we'll get to that a little bit later. So the cast and crew trained for underwater diving for a week in the Cayman Islands, and it was necessary because 40% of all the live-action principal photography was going to be done underwater. Cameron's production company had to design and build experimental equipment and develop a state-of-the-art communication system that allowed the director to talk underwater to the actors and dialogue to be recorded directly onto tape from those suits and tanks for the first time ever, rather than being looped later. Cameron had originally planned to shoot on location in the Bahamas where the story was set, but quickly realized that he needed to have a completely controlled environment because of the stunts and special visual effects involved. He considered shooting the film in Malta, which had the largest unfiltered tank of water, but it wasn't adequate for his needs. Underwater sequences for the film were shot at a unit of the Gaffney Studios situated outside Gaffney, South Carolina, which had been abandoned by Duke Power officials after previously spending $700 million constructing the Cherokee nuclear power plant. So two specially constructed tanks were used. The first one, based on the abandoned plant's primary reactor containment vessel, held 7.5 million gallons of water. It was 55 feet deep and 209 feet across. At the time, it was the largest freshwater filtered tank in the world. Additional scenes were shot in the second tank, an unused turbine pit, which held 2.5 million U.S. gallons. As a production crew rushed to finish painting the main tank, millions of gallons of water poured in and took 5 days to fill. The deep core rig was anchored to a 90-ton concrete column at the bottom of the tank. It consisted of 6 partial and complete modules that took over a year and a half to plan and build from scratch. CanDive Services Limited, a Canadian commercial diving company that specialized in saturation diving systems and underwater tech, specially manufactured the two working craft, which you see in the film, Flatbed and Cab One, for the film. And $2 million alone was spent on set construction. So with that little background, let's get to the film. So we open, before we even see anything, we open with a ping of a submarine sonar. And we get right into the action. We're on an American nuclear sub tracking some bogey moving faster than anything man-made in the water, so we hear. They put it up on the speakers. They don't recognize the noise of the power plant. I guess in a lot of sub-to-sub warfare and espionage, you know, power plants from various subs are the signature of the power plant is noticed, or, you know, surface ships, so on and so forth. So right away, you know, they're thrown off because this power plant doesn't exist on any of their, you know, charts or anything else. And very solid production design. You know, when you're in the sub, feels like a real sub rather than a Hollywood set. Pretty claustrophobic, you know. Cameron doesn't create the bridge of the Enterprise as a sub. Like, subs are pretty cramped places, and I feel it. We see an odd light move off screen over the sub, obviously, that the folks on the sub can't see, which is then cuts off briefly. And then the sub winds up colliding with a cliff. Basically, this light, as it comes near them, that whenever the aliens in this movie get anywhere near human machinery, it tends to have a dampening or effect where it just shuts it down completely. And when they pass, it kind of starts up again. So there's sort of like an EMP-like effect that it has when it gets close to these things. But when the sub regains their systems, it's too late, and there's this cliff sort of right next to them. And basically, the sub goes down, and we get, you know, the Dutch angle camera on the sub, you know, letting us know that the sub itself is at a weird angle. And there's a point where, you know, they know they're dead meat, and the captain says to, I think, his XO, you know, launch the buoy, meaning that, you know, they're pretty much dead in the water. So then we cut right away to a surface exploration platform, and immediately, you know, they know what's going on, and a military unit has been choppered in. There's a great little camera thing here where the camera is focusing on the ground right in front of a chopper. And we see military boots hitting the ground one after the other as these soldiers get off. And we hear, you know, the snare drums soundtrack. And then the last set of legs and feet to emerge from the chopper are in hose and high heels. So it's the emergence of Lindsay Brigman, Bud's estranged wife. Introduction to Lindsay's character. She's really, really intense and gets on the ship, and she's angry that her boss, I guess the people who own the rig, who've backed it financially, are allowing the military to take it over and use it to retrieve the sub, because all the stuff that the military has is too far away, and there's a storm coming, so it's sort of born out of necessity. But she's very unforgiving of others' failures and very intense. Then we cut to our first shot of the underwater rig, which is kind of like a small house underwater. The underwater photography in this film, pretty much all the way through, is phenomenal. And the Blu-ray to come, I would hope, is going to really kind of resurface this film with critics and others, and make one realize that it was shot in such a way that it does not feel like an 80s film. He shot it kind of in a way Ridley shot Alien, and that you can watch Alien now and it doesn't date in terms of its classicism. He really embraced the classicism with The Abyss. Even his Aliens feels like an 80s kind of action movie, as does The Terminator. But with The Abyss, I feel like it's going to translate a lot further down the decades because of the way he shot it and how clear everything is, and just it's really, really well crafted and classically shot. Can't wait for the Blu-ray, because I think it's gonna really pop. So we do a very Alien-like introduction to the crew. You know, very similar. Made me think of the beginning of Alien, where, you know, we hear so often that the truck drivers in space. Well, these are truck drivers at the bottom of the sea. And it's very gritty, and the rig looks good inside. It's very dingy. I don't get the sense that this is a Hollywood rig. You know, it really looks used, and the crew have sort of their own idiosyncratic dress, you know, and hats that they wear, and music that they listen to. And it really grounds the film in a realism that I think you're going to need as it, you know, especially the last third of the film, as it starts to take off into flights of fancy. You're really starting it here with this gritty, no holes barred. These aren't a bunch of scientists. You know, it's, again, it's like Alien. It's not a bunch of people whooping it up because they found ET. They're pissed off that they can't get home and collect their money. So I think that's a really great choice, and I think he pulls it off really well. And Ed Harris, man, what a casting coup here. I think so much of the success of this film, first of all, I think him and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio are really center the film, and the relationship centers the film, as I think Cameron wanted to. But man, Harris is so good. He's so good. And immediately, he's just a solid everyman Marine engineer doing his job. From the minute you see him, you know, like he just really, really inhabits the part. I just feel like he's cast to type. It all works. I do feel like he's the boss of these people. And yet, he's not domineering we're made out to, he's given lines to say that prove he's the boss. You know, you know it from the minute he's on screen. He has such an authenticity to him and a down to earthness, I think Ed Harris always has, that really grounds him in this film and really grounds the film too. So let me cut back up to the ship on the surface, and we're getting a bit of a briefing by the military authorities. And we hear that the sub that went down is called the USS Montana. 156 souls down with her. The characters in the film who work for the rig company ask the right questions. Hey, doesn't the military have equipment for this? And, you know, Cameron creates this conflict of the storm. You know, so we got a clock here. So, you know, obviously they don't have time to get all of their stuff out to the location. And the briefing is being done real time with the guys on the rig down below and, you know, up top. So they're kind of in a conference call, as it were. This character named Carnes, who I think they call Hippie, he's the guy who has a rat on his shoulder pretty much the whole film, asks another great question. He says, hey, man, you know, why would I want to do this? And they quickly answer in a sort of alien-like way that the boss says that they're going to be paid three times their normal pay, you know, in a sense, hazard pay to do this. So the crew immediately erupts into cheers, and you've been given a believable motivation for these people to go do this thing. So I thought there was a very subtle moment that they just didn't grumble and say, okay, we'll go check out the sub, but they immediately said, screw you, man, you know, I'm not cut out for this. I'm not a deep sea military marine guy. You know, I'm down here looking for oil and getting paid for it. Like, I'm not doing all this extra crap. And the camera to come up with the real incentive that you get three-quarter, you know, think about your job. And if your boss asked you to do something that was a little outside the purview of it and you really didn't want to do it, and he said, you're going to get three times your normal salary, you know, what your own reaction would be. And I thought that was really clever and smart for the film. And boom, just like that, right, we're into the story. And I think this is Cameron in his period where, for my money, he could do no wrong. That started with The Terminator and I think ended, frankly, with T2. So The Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, and T2 were Cameron in his vintage form of storytelling where his scripts were really, really tight, really well thought out, very believable. And they just, you know, he's sort of like the Michael Crichton of film. Where if you read a Michael Crichton novel, and then those books are put together like clockwork. They just move and cook from the minute you start them to the end. They're put together in a very lean, economical fashion. And I feel like Cameron was the, you know, the sci-fi action movie equivalent of that. The scripts were so tight and so well thought out and so seamless and assured. There was hardly any BS in his stuff. I think The Abyss is a great example of that. So we have a brief initial back and forth between Lindsay and Bud, who are estranged husband and wife. And she's like, Bud, you worm, you know, you just rolled over and let them do, you know, let them take over the rig. And he's like, look, I'm a paid worker. I go where I'm told. He cuts her off, basically. And, you know, we realize that he really hates her. Up to this moment, we don't realize that they're married. And Hippie turns to him and says, you probably shouldn't have married her then. So boom. Introduction to their relationship. Lindsay, in the tradition of Cameron heroines such as Linda Hamilton and Sigourney Weaver, you know, fully action hero herself and pilots, is probably the best pilot of all of these submersibles. So she is the pilot taking the military guys down to the rig. And there's a great moment where you realize she's fully in command and sort of has the edge on these guys when they drop the rig into the water pretty unceremoniously, and it smashes down, and all the military dudes are like thrown around, and she casually tosses it off and turns around, and she's like, sorry, you know. Really great introduction to the power of her character. And we get a little information about what's going to come up later. When they get down to the rig, they have to sit in a decompression chamber for about 8 hours, and we're introduced to this syndrome called HPNS, which is, I guess, a deep-sea diver syndrome. Which occurs for real, and it affects the human nervous system. And some people just kind of get it, some people don't. It sort of affects your cognitive abilities, and we're given the telltale signs, such as tremors in your hand and slurred speech and so on and so forth. And all of the SEALs brush her off because they're super tough guys, saying, we're checked out, we've checked out. And she reiterates that just the point is that there's no way to screen for who would be susceptible to HPNS, so on and so forth. So, you know, that little seed is thrown into the script, which it's going to pay off pretty quickly. And of course, one little nit I have with this movie is the decompression that they all have to undergo. She explains that it would take 3 weeks for them to decompress on the return trip to the surface. That's how deep they are. And of course, at the end of the film, the alien ship brings them all up in, you know, less than 2 minutes. And they even remark when they step out of the, you know, rig on the surface, like, oh, look, the decompression, you know, we should be dead. It must be something the aliens did, you know. And I recognize it as a trope that the film has to truck into so they can have Lindsay and Bud embrace at the end of the film, which is, I think, probably pretty important in terms of just seeing people on screen care about each other. That moment, you know, at the end of any film when the music swells and the two people come together. I feel like psychologists could probably study that effect for decades because every film does it, every director does it who does big movies. There just seems to be something magical and satisfying emotionally that we might not even be aware of consciously. You know, when two characters who've been estranged or apart, you know, come together physically in that kind of embrace. So Cameron dispenses with science in this moment at the end. But anyway, we'll get to that when we get to it. As Lindsay gets into the rig, it's a very comfortable situation, you know, and he set us up with the rig crew so well. They just seem so much a natural part of the space. And she knows them all because she designed the rig that they're working in. And she's, you know, hey, Lindsay, how are you? None of them really like her, you know. When they found out that she was coming down, you see certain characters wince at certain points, like, ah, you know, and this is a little bit of out of fashion, you know, calling her the bitch from hell, cast iron bitch, bitch, bitch. So the B word is thrown around. We don't really do that in films anymore. We've evolved now. We kind of use other words to denote someone who's irritating. if they happen to be female or male, it doesn't matter. But it's interesting that that's kind of still in play in the late 80s. And right off, when we cut back to Coffee, who's played by Michael Biehn, by the way, who's really great in this. I think he's a pretty solid bad guy. He scares the crap out of me every time I see this film. And obviously, you know, he was Reese in Terminator and Hicks in Aliens, and here he is as Lieutenant Coffee in The Abyss. Immediately, we see him grab some gear and look at his hand, which has started to shake. So now we already know that the leader of the SEALs is probably going to be susceptible to all of the signs and things that we said earlier. So pretty solid about Cameron, explains the phenomenon, and then boom, we see it in action, you know, a couple of shots later. We see the back and forth between Bud and Lindsay. She's kind of walking around the rig looking at things like, why is this set in this position? Obviously, she's designed the rig, but she's been off it for a while, and it's been kind of jury-rigged by the crew. And we can see that Bud really still has feelings for her, but she's really, like, just not, you know, we never know what really happened, but she seems very antagonistic and very consistently angry at him for reasons we know not, but he's still kind of sweet on her. And it's all telegraphed. This is one of my favorite scenes in the film. After the conversation between the two of them, she says something really nasty to him. And he's just like, he walks into the lavatory, which is in this chemical toilet. Basically, the toilet is filled with this blue liquid, which I guess is a, you know, antiseptic of some kind. He takes off his wedding ring, and he throws it down the chemical toilet and slams the door. And then the camera waits a beat, still shooting from inside the lavatory. And then a beat later, the door opens. He comes back into the room, and he's like, he's exhaling, and something about his face. And he sits down. And he jams his hand and arm down into the toilet, and he finds the ring. He pulls it back out. You know, his one arm is totally covered in blue goo, and he sticks it back on his hand. And I thought, they should teach that in film school, about how you, rather than having Bud talk to another character, or even to Lindsay himself, say, you know, babe, you know, I still love us, and I still have hopes that it's going to work out. Or if he talked to someone else on the rig, saying, look, you still got feelings for her, don't you, Bud? Nah, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, any of this kind of like quasi-cliché dialogue. But instead, what if we learn by a purely visual scene with no words exactly how Bud feels about his wife? You know, he also is very frustrated with her, and probably parts of her is like, why do I bother? Why do I bother? And it's a very complex relationship between, you know, men and women have been married for years, right? The relationships are so complex. They're not black and white for anybody. This scene is able to convey that information in pure physicality and visual. So I'm a huge fan of it. So in the next few scenes, they're preparing to dive on the sub, and we're introduced to the fluid breathing system, which is one of the cool things about this film. I mean, I literally, I'm kind of a science nerd when I was a kid, and I keep up, you know, with various blogs and trades to see what's going on. I remember seeing the Abyss even back then, and I thought, this has got to be fake. You know, there's no way this is real. And it's completely real. And not only that, the scene with the rat was real. They put the rat, basically what happens is one of the lieutenants, who turns out to be a nice guy by the end of the movie, who's in charge of this system, takes Hippie's rat and puts it in this liquid and then puts a cage over it so it can't breathe and can't get out. And we watch it on camera adjust to the fluid breathing system. And it really happened. They really did it that way. And it's really oxygenated fluorocarbon fluid, that's what it's called, was used in that scene. They cut away briefly because the rat defecated in the tank. It was so freaked out and so scared that it actually defecated. And so I guess you saw rat droppings on screen and, you know, that wasn't going to happen in a Hollywood movie. So they cut away at a certain point to focus on Hippie's face and his emotions worrying about his pet rat. And in that moment, the rat had defecated. Then they stopped. They cleared the, you know, rat feces out of it and then shot it back again, which I thought was really kind of interesting. And the guys who pioneered it were consulted on the film, which is kind of cool. So they were, you know, Cameron is such an engineering geek. They used five different rats for five different takes. All who survived were given antibiotic shots by a vet just to be sure. The rat that actually appeared in the film died of natural causes a few weeks before the film opened. And according to Cameron, the scene with the rat had to be edited out of the UK movie version because the royal veterinarian felt that it was painful for the rat, which is interesting. And he continually assures that the rats used for the movie didn't suffer any harm. So kind of cool. Now we get our first dive down to the sub, and the underwater photography in this film is brilliant. It's no surprise that he went on to do Ghosts of the Abyss and, you know, the sort of intro and outro to Titanic and all kinds of documentaries. I mean, I think he's just fascinated with, and, you know, instead of space for him, I think underwater is sort of the next frontier for Cameron. And the underwater photography is really, really beautiful. The design of the helmets are great. They're kind of these geometric shapes that are really neat. They look very functional, too. They don't look like fake kind of sci-fi movie helmets. They look like kind of tough dive helmets, which I think is a great choice. You know, anything that continues to lead to the grittiness, realism of any kind of speculative film, always a great thing. We're introduced to the robot vehicles, Big Geek and Little Geek, which obviously Cameron kind of saw in that documentary years ago and brought into the story. And we get some information that there are 192 warheads on the sub, 50 kilotons each, which is basically five times Hiroshima. So they dive down and they go into the sub to look for survivors. And the interior of the sub looks amazing. Lots and lots of garbage floating around. And at one point, Jammer, who's this big character on the rig, and Catfish and Coffee and Bud are inside, the four of them, checking for bodies. And we see our first dead body, and Jammer is really freaked out. And it's a neat scene where we see a crab kind of come out of its mouth, which is a really kind of creepy little scene in this film like this. They reach the bridge, we see more bodies, and then they split up, and it's just Jammer and Bud now. This is where Jammer sees the crabs come out of the corpse's mouth, and he really loses it. So Bud leaves him in the bridge, and he continues on with some rope, basically telling him, you know, tug two times if something happens. Of course, you know, it's like a horror movie setup, right? So we cut to Coffee briefly as well, and we see him retrieving the nuclear launch codes, you know, a little sinister moment there. And then the lights go out on the bridge and in Jammer's suit briefly. And he can't contact anyone, and he freaks out, and he tugs on the cord, and we see the cord is caught on some piece of, you know, busted wall, and it cuts itself. And so he completely freaks out, and then we see him see something very bright and sort of fluorescent through his reflection on his faceplate, some kind of phosphorescent creature. We don't get to see too much of it then. But he bolts, and in bolting, he slams the top of his breathing rig on a bulkhead, damages it, and he starts convulsing. Outside, in one of the submersibles, Lindsay sees a full-on ET come right near her, kind of spin around and vanish. So, you know, she's gotten her first sighting of them. What's going to be called the NTIs, non-terrestrial intelligence. There's some tension about getting Jammer back out, about him convulsing, and about getting the oxygen mixed. So pretty solid sub-mystery dead body scene, you know, really kind of cool. And then Jammer winds up in a coma. So he's out in a coma on this in the med bay. And Lindsay starts telling Bud about what she saw. And of course, the military is there as well. And they relay the message topside. No one else has seen it. No one else really kind of believes Lindsay. But we also hear that two Russian subs were tracked nearby, which is now escalating our tension in terms of the military. And we hear something between the military guys about going to phase two, about retrieving and arming one of the nuclear warheads and waiting for further instructions. So obviously, you know, we're getting a sense that the military have a slash and burn policy that if there are Russian subs in the area and it's found out that they have underwater retrieval capabilities, that they're going to set off the warhead and everyone will get killed, but they will have protected American sub technology from being taken by the Russians. Height of the Cold War, you know, we forget the Cold War is over now, but 1989, height of the Cold War, right before Glasnost. So this was still a big reality. And we're also given a bit of a political situation. They're actually only 80 miles from Cuba, and now sort of there are national defense buildups, and the Americans are sending some ships and, you know, that possibly may come to the area, although there's a storm coming. So I think this is part of the uber world political plot that got cut and I think put back into the extended Abyss edition, which came out, I think, you know, when it was came out on DVD. There was also an extended edition that had a whole extra little plot that took place around the world. So now we get the big complication. The storm's coming. They need this big Cab 1, I think, is the big submersible to unhook the surface umbilical from the rig. So the surface umbilical could go to port, wait out the storm. They're underwater. They're safe. The storm's over. They come back. So in order to retrieve the nuke, the military guys just jump in Cab 1 without telling anyone and bail down to the sub to get the nuke. They come back so late that, you know, by the, you know, this is the great complication, is that the surface ship is still tethered to the rig and it's starting to get lashed by the storm above. We get a brief scene of the military retrieving the warhead and Coffey's hands shaking yet again. And now the rig on at top, as the storm hits, starts to swing out of position and it drags the rig along with it, which is a great complication. And one knight, who's one of the female drivers of these submersibles, can't get in to separate the umbilical because of the way it's being thrashed around. So at one point, the crane that would have pulled the rig up ultimately into the surface ship when the entire mission was over is ripped out of the surface ship and collapses down. And so it's now heading straight for the rig, which is pretty amazing. So this is kind of a neat little what good luck, what bad luck kind of thing, where we start seeing the cables fall just outside the rig, and we know that this huge crane is on its way down. The crane hits right next to the rig. It just misses it. And so we get this false relief on everyone, and then the crane sort of twists and turns and falls, and they're right near the edge of this massive abyss, hence the name of the film. And it slips into that chasm, now dragging the rig with it. And it's a great complication. So they lose a submersible. I think one SEAL is killed. And it's this incredible scene where the rig is dragged right to the edge of the chasm. And then finally, at some point, I think the crane bottoms out. But the rig has been, you know, badly damaged. Parts of it are flooded. It's a really intense scene. Bud nearly drowns, and there's this moment where he's trying to get out of one chamber and into another, and an emergency door closes, and he puts his hand in to try to stop it, and it stops because of the wedding ring on his finger, and we can see that clearly. And then he's able to get a crowbar in and winch it back open and get through. So it's kind of a nice little moment in terms of him retrieving, you know, that his devotion to his wife actually saved his life in this instance, which I thought was kind of cool. And there's a great rescue scene, you know, by Catfish. He finally comes and gets him out. And so they get there. And when this whole huge, it's a pretty long sequence and pretty intense, really well shot, really well filmed. At the end, you know, Coffey, you know, for all his faults, says, "I was under orders. I really had no choice." And now we're faced with the consequences of this, that they have 12 hours of oxygen left, and it's going to get very cold because the heaters are not working. So they've lost a lot of power and a lot of systems. And then there's a nice moment between Lindsay and Bud. Well, you see Bud's like, "Hey, I'm really glad you're here." And she's like, "Well, I'm not." So still, she's not at all, you know, connecting with Bud. And, you know, Bud is still trying, basically. So it's kind of interesting. And Harris is great. I mean, you could see that he's really sweet on her still. And it just comes right out of him. So Lindsay's outside in the next scene doing some repair work. We get this moment where an ET rises up and it kills all the power around her. Beautiful photography yet again. And so Lindsay's near this abyss, you know, looking over it, and the power dies, and we see our first ET in this beautiful, beautiful design, you know, seemingly based on real deep sea creatures. So I think Cameron really used these really, really super deep creatures to design these aliens, and they look wonderful. They're kind of translucent, and they have these fluorescent colors and lights all through them, but we can see actual humanoid figures sort of inside. Which is really, they're really beautiful looking. And a really big ship comes very close. So there's no mistaking that this is a full-on NTI. And she's able to touch it this time. And in the awe and wonder of the moment, you know, it slips away really quickly, and she takes a picture of it with an underwater camera way too late, and we cut right back to the rig, and all it is like a, you know, a fluorescent pink smear. And again, nobody believes her. Lindsay takes Bud aside, and she's like, listen, you have to believe me. And he's like, Lince, you know, we're hanging together by threads here. I can't. And, you know, again, this is her character, still very selfish still. It's all about her. You know, she just, you know, she wants what she wants. She says what she says. You have to believe me, this, that. You know, not thinking of what it's going to do to the other people on the rig. And he's trying to keep things together. You know, he's really, again, inhabiting the role of the head of this rig effortlessly, where he's like, I'm trying to keep things together, man. I can't go off on these flights of fancy. She's like, you have to believe me. And she's just off in her own world doing her own thing. So she's not a likable character yet, but there are things about her that we like. And there's something about her awe and wonder of what's going on that is very likable. And at the same time, we see kind of her selfish and one-dimensional nature to who she is as well. So it's kind of neat, kind of very complex character there. So then we get a scene where the SEALs are disemboweling a warhead to kind of program it. And Hippie is using one of his remote submersibles and spies on them from a porthole. The submersible's out in the water and they're inside and clearly sees what they're doing. And this leads to this confrontation. And we're, again, Lindsay not thinking about anything else but how she feels about the situation. Storms into their hold and, like, it gets right in their face. And we see Coffee sweating and he's got his hand behind his back. And we don't know what's there, but we, of course, know what's there. And there's a full-on confrontation as he gets the military guys to remove Lindsay. And then Bud calls the rest of the guys in the rig who back him up. And so they let her go. And the tension's amazing because we can see that Coffee is like, he's going. You know, the paranoia is just like ratcheted up to this crazy level. And she's just provoking him. And it's a great tension device for the audience. And of course, as the rig crew leaves, the camera kind of pivots behind Coffee. And we see that, in fact, he did have a weapon there. We have a little bit of a seed moment here where Lindsay convinces Hippie to send one of the remotes down to where she thinks the alien came from. So he's programming that. And there's a cute moment between Bud and Lindsay where Bud's sleeping and he's snoring. And she says quietly to his face, Virgil, turn on your side. And he does. And we realize that's probably something that had happened, you know, during their married years. So cute little moment. I really liked it.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, $4 a month, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi On Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $35 per podcast right now. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/sci-fi-on-screen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah. No, blah, blah, blah.
So now we get the tentacle moment, the water tentacle, which is kind of a big deal in this movie. And in movies, plural, this technology, which was pretty much invented whole cloth by Industrial Light and Magic, was a huge moment in, you know, kind of the birth of modern CGI. Spawned all kinds of stuff. And in 1989, led directly to Spielberg's film and, you know, the explosion of CGI that we're, for better or for worse, are currently into today. So pretty interesting. And all the actors had to act with, I think, a guy walking around with a piece of tubing and hose, and they had to make believe that it was obviously the creature. And it's nice. We're sort of given the audiences at fisheye lens view, so we're the point of view of the tentacle. Kind of has a horror movie vibe for a little bit. It comes and looks in over two of the sleeping crew. And then when it gets to Lindsay, you know, she basically wakes up. I think it's her, Bud, One Night, and Catfish, and they all see it. And they get this wonderful moment of it forms Lindsay's face and it forms Bud's face. And she puts her finger in the salt water and tastes it. They had Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Ed Harris's face laser scanned. ILM had them scan their contours of their face in order to do the CGI in post later on. It looks great, actually. So kind of a nice moment of a fairly benign intelligence that is just trying to make contact. So they follow it through the ship. It continues on and it gets to the room where the nuclear warhead is. And so the SEALs see it. And Coffee, of course, basically on the edge, hits the door close button, and when the hatch door closes, it breaks sort of the spell. The tentacle collapses, and it's gone from the ship. But a great sense of wonder about it. You know, we start off, like, the first really two-thirds of this film is really centered on the gritty nature of the rig and the submarine and the mission and all that. And now, you know, we're starting to drop into a new movie, which is kind of like about, you know, ETs or NTIs, as they're called in this film. And the tone's changing a little bit, so we get this sense of wonder in the midst of this sort of claustrophobic hell. So there's a great scene later where they're all talking about it, and the camera slowly dips below the counter, and we see that Coffee is slicing his forearm with a knife, basically cutting himself to try to keep himself from completely losing his mind. Really kind of a creepy moment. And he gets aside with one of his other lieutenants, and he's like, "It went right for the warhead. We got to go to phase three." And his lieutenants at that point realize that he's kind of gone and trying to calm him down. But at that point, Coffee's done, and he's locking and loading. He offers him – it's a great visual moment because the lieutenant's not really comfortable with Coffee's condition, but Coffee offers him a loaded rifle, and he pauses, and then he grabs it. And so you know basically that, you know, he's going to do what his commander says. So at this point, they burst in on the crew. They take them hostage, you know, at gunpoint, and stick them in one of the – you know, the rooms that close the porthole and dog the hatch. And they realize that they're going to put the warhead on one of the remotes, which Hippie had just finished programming to go down to where the NTI was, you know, hypothesized to be, the bottom of this abyssal trench. So they realize they're going to strap the nuke on. It's going to lead them right to the NTI. So they're locked in. You know, we don't really know what's going to happen next. And all of a sudden, the door opens and it's Jammer pulling a Han Solo here. And he has just woken up from his coma and surprised the two SEALs, knocking them down, taking their weapons. And, you know, now the crew is free. So our next problem is they dogged the hatch pretty badly to the moon pool, which is where all the submersibles are. So in order for them to get, you know, anywhere near the SEALs to stop them from doing this thing with the warhead, Bud is going to try to swim for the main open bay where they launch the subs from. First, they're going to try, you know, so it's him and Catfish, so they're going to do this thing where, you know, it's freezing and they're way down. They get to the one hatch that they were planning on getting to. Bud makes it, you know, Catfish makes it, but that hatch is also blocked, so he's going to do one more swim to the actual moon pool, which is this open underwater bay. So then there's a great tension where Bud arrives in the moon pool and he has to get out of the water really quietly because Coffee, basically he's in this weird position where Coffee's sitting there and he's pulling the chain. You know, the chain is on some sort of a lifting device which makes a click sound every time a, you know, part of the device turns. And it's kind of calming Coffee down the way cutting was. So he's just sitting there slowly pulling on the chain one click at a time. He's already attached the nuke and the, you know, the little submersible to the main ship, and he just seems to be there waiting, you know, I guess waiting for his other guys to show up, and he's just kind of in this quiet place. So it's great tension when Bud sneaks up on him, and Bud grabs this huge pipe, and he has him dead to rights, basically. He could swing and take him down, but instead he tries to go for his gun, and the minute he reaches towards it, he tips Coffee off, and there they start to fight. And it's a pretty intense scene. The way Cameron shoots it is that each combatant is staring into the camera. So as you're watching the movie, you're looking right at Bud as he's, you know, he's defending himself with this pipe, and then you cut, and it's Coffee flicking out with a knife. And they're close enough to the camera, and it's really intense. So I thought it was a really good choice rather than have two really non-stunt people. In 89, when we weren't doing what we do now, where guys are training for months to be fighters, you know. So it's a good way to kind of give us intensity of a fight without actually showing or, you know, cutting to stunt people or, you know, not having it as telegraphed as we do today. So I don't know. I like the choice that they made. And Cameron does this extra thing where he sets things swinging in between the two of them. So as they're fighting, they're also dodging out of the way of these cables and these lights. And it's a great, you know, it's just a pure cinematic thing. Maybe his DP came up with it, but really smart. And you get this, you know, this thing where they're dodging and slashing at each other through these swinging lights and cables. Like, it's really cool. And at some point, Bud, you know, they do this correctly in that even though Coffee's half gone with, you know, paranoia and shakes, and he's a trained killer, he's a Navy SEAL, Bud's pretty much getting the worst part of it, and he's about to get killed. Catfish steps in, does another Han Solo because they've finally gotten, he had finally swum the distance. We didn't think he was going to because he told Bud earlier that I can't make it, you got to go on your own. But he makes it just in time, you know, knocks Coffee right on his ass. He's a huge dude, which is great. So saves Bud's butt. But in the, you know, as he turns to see if Bud's okay, Coffee goes for the submersible, gets in, and now, you know, we continue on as with this underwater chase. So pretty, you know, it's a pretty lengthy underwater sub chase. And I have to give it to Cameron that you pretty much can see what's going on at all times. You know where they are in relation to each other and the rig most of the time, not all the time, but you follow it pretty well. And it's got some good tension. It's not done too, you know, overly long. At first, Bud jumps in the water with just a suit on and Lindsay jumps in a submersible. So Coffee releases Big Geek with the warhead. And as it starts to head towards the trench, Bud ties a line to it and ties another piece of it to the rig. So for the moment, it's held. It can't go anywhere, which is neat. But he's about to get squashed by Coffee, and then Lindsay intercepts with her sub, and now it's on. Bud actually gets into Lindsay's sub, so the two of them are in the one sub. And so it's basically sub versus sub throughout most of it. And at one point, finally, Lindsay kind of knocks him around. And what's cool about the way they do this here is they use miniature submersibles. And what they did is they put little cameras, little screens inside the submersible. So when you're watching it, you're seeing these miniature submersibles, but they're projecting the real actors who recorded their dialogue and movements. It's off on a stage somewhere. And so that's being replayed. So we're seeing a tape of the actors who recorded in this little bubble in the miniatures. And it looks really clear. And it's a really clever way to have us believe that we're really looking at these ships and that they're not miniatures. So, you know, non-CGI special effects, you know, kind of old school. I thought it was really clever. I really liked how they did that. And so it ends with Coffee's rig kind of poised to go over the abyss and Bud and Lindsay and their rig, you know, resting on the cliff. And they're both looking at each other through these large bubbles. And of course, Coffee's rig slips down and we follow him down. And little by little, the pressure grows and we see the little bubble crack more and more. And finally, it implodes completely. And, you know, Coffee is dead. So then, probably the most intense and memorable scene in this whole film. Really, really an amazing thing that was written and that was acted and how it was brought off. And that the sub that Lindsay and Bud are in is leaking slowly and the water's coming in and they can't find a way to fix it. And it starts off as a simple thing where Bud knows it's a simple crescent wrench he needs, but he can't get behind this panel. He's like, man, I just need one bloody wrench and he doesn't have it. But they can't stop the leak, so it's slowly rising. The camera gives us a moment to pause with them as us audience members are like, all right, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? And, you know, Cameron and the writers are one step ahead of us because who the hell would come up with this solution in the audience, you know, which is just genius. The water's really cold. And so Lindsay comes up with the idea that he allows her to drown and the cold water will slow her systems enough that she won't go into full brain death because everything will slow to a crawl. And then tow her body back. Since Bud's the stronger swimmer, he tows her back to the rig and they revive her. And man, they really play it out. They really wait until the water is. They keep the camera on Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, and she's terrific. You know, because when he goes underwater to put the suit on, she has second thoughts about it, but he can't hear her and she's afraid. And we stay on her without cutting until the water goes all the way up to the top. And then we see her start to drown, but I think Cameron's very graceful about this, which I like. Bud's holding her, and her face is to the other side of the camera, of his helmet. We don't see her, but we're focused on her hand, and it tenses up, and it tenses up, and then finally lets go, and we realize she's dead, you know? So another great way of telegraphing what's going on just by, you know, looking at the screen and having no dialogue. It's wonderful. I mean, you know, it's incredibly melodramatic, but man, how could you not be in it at this moment? It's not been a melodramatic film up till now, so you can forgive the melodrama of her dying and coming back to life, because it's so intense, and the actors are so good, both of them, that you really, really buy into it. And so now back on the rig, you know, they're trying to revive her, and, you know, they try for a time, and she just doesn't come back. And so everyone there is, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, an ER or Chicago Hope or any kind of hospital show scene, right, where people lean in, and they're like, she's gone, man, you know, she's gone, like, you got to let her go. And there's a point where Bud does. He kind of sits back and lets her go. And then he flips out and he's like, no! And he screams and he starts hitting her again. And Harris is unbelievable here. Really unbelievable. You know, at the penultimate point, he's like, you never ran away from your fight in your life, you bitch. Fight, blah, blah, blah. Fight, damn you. And at this moment, the camera's right on Harris and he's acting to, no one's below him at this point. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio had, you know, and she's on the sideline. So he's acting to nothing. But man, this is his crowning moment in this film. I think he's so intense here and so believable and so very good. Kind of an amazing Ed Harris moment. And of course, you know, it's a wonderful moment where she actually revives and, every, you know, there's a wonderful release for the audience and the crew as well. They're all clapping each other on the back and it's amazing. You know, and Cameron is good at pushing us way past comfortable. You know, like he does it in this scene, like it's way past comfortable where we as the audience are like, all right, but you know, come on, she's dead. What are you doing, man? And I'm even uncomfortable watching it. And so when she comes back, it's, a, you know, it's the magic of cinema, right, of how it works. And it's really wonderful. So a little bit of trivia. During the scene, Harris, again, like I said, he wasn't acting with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. Beneath him, he was yelling in thin air because some of the scenes she was in, he was pounding and slapping her for real because he's kind of a method guy. So he, you know, he goes all out. And at some point, you know, during a second or third or fourth take, they realized they didn't have any film in the camera. They ran out of film and she just lost it. And she was, you know, she's out there, her breasts hanging out for everyone to see. And the third or fourth time getting roughhoused and by Ed Harris, you know, and surrounded by all these other people. And she just refused to come back on set again. So they had to use what they had. And Harris had to finish the scene to empty space, basically. And you know, when you watch the documentary of the making of it, nobody blames her that she'd been through the mill at that point, you know, and no one really blames her for leaving. So, you know, again, another amazing moment. You know, the end of this film, it's one of the few sci-fi films where the climaxes are great and that I don't feel exhausted at the end of the film because each one is so unique. You had the sub chase, which was kind of cool. Then you had this amazing resuscitation scene, which is kind of cool. And then this scene, which is Bud's going to don this fluid breathing apparatus, which is really kind of cool because they want to retrieve the nuke. I think it's on a timer down by the NTI. So Bud wants to go down and retrieve it to, you know, do the right thing. And we're told that when he has this fluid in his lungs, it prevents him from speaking because the fluid kind of stops it from vibrating or stops the vibrations from going anywhere, basically. So he has to type in using a little keypad on his forearm. And it's very realistically filmed. What I found out was they actually filmed Harris in underwater in a suit filled with pink fluid. You know, so when you see him in this suit, in any shot, he's holding his breath and there's real water in there, which is amazing. And they designed the suit so the faceplate could pop up at any moment. And the divers, the safety divers who were always just out of camera range in any shot in case anything went wrong, they had all these extra breathers and oxygen with them that he was able to, once the take was over, he would snap up the faceplate and they would rush in with the breather and get him breathing again. But, you know, imagine you're an actor and you're in this huge tank, you know, filled with millions of gallons of water and you're down doing the scene. And then you got to hold your breath inside your helmet underwater and act on top of it. So amazing to think that he pulled this off. So the descent is beautiful. You know, they had to film it in very short takes because of the breath holding issue, but it looks really wonderful. And he's just going down and holding on to the other submersible that's programmed to go to the same place. And because he's going down so fast, he doesn't have a chance to acclimate to the pressure, so he's starting to shake. His hands aren't typing well, and we're seeing it on the screen from the point of view of the rest of the crew. His typing is starting to, you know, there's one point where they can't understand what he's saying. You know, it's a great character moment, too, because One Knight says, talk to him, Lindsay. You know, not just BS, but you got to talk to him. You got to keep him focused on your voice so he doesn't lose it. So Lindsay has this tender moment, this confessional in front of everyone, kind of talking about who she is and the quote, you know, it's not easy being a cast iron bitch. It takes years of practice. So she's kind of being very honest about, you know, who she is and who people think she is and possibly who she is with Bud as well. And we see Bud visibly in pain when he's losing, you know, contact and he's not even able to type. And the pressure gets so great that Little Geek dies. So he's all on his own. And it's a great tension scene because we're seeing the reaction of the crew saying, my God, 15,000 feet, why the hell did we agree to this? Holy cow. Like, we see them, these seasoned pros, these seasoned vets, freaking out about how deep Bud is going. And now that they've lost contact and lost telemetry, and he can barely type, they're all like, why did we let him do this? You know, so as the audience member, it's a good, you know, kind of an old-fashioned way of giving us tension. You're not blowing stuff up and showing me all this stuff. You're showing me good friends of the main character and how worried and freaked out they are. And so I empathize with them, and I worry about Bud too. So this is Cameron at his peak when he was just a master. However, he gets to the bottom. The pressure equalizes for whatever reason. And so he's okay. But his light goes out. And this is another cool little thing for the tension, Cameron. It's unbelievable. the main light flare goes out, and he has to crack one of these sort of yellow emergency lights. And so we hear the military guy talking him through the wire, saying, you know, you want to cut the black wire, the black with the white stripe, you know, not the, you know, white with the yellow stripe. And in the light that he's using, because it's yellow, you can't tell the difference in the two wires. So there's this moment of like, he's going to cut one, then he stops, and he picks the other one, and he clicks it. You know, classic diffusing of the bomb tension, which is great. And he does it. And then, you know, we get a relief, and then Cameron throws us another curveball, and we find out that he only has 5 minutes of oxygen left, and they realize it took him most of the way just to get down there, way longer than they thought. And because the pressure is so great, he used up his oxygen faster than they predicted. And so they all freak out, and they're like, drop your weights and float back up. You'll make it. We'll meet you halfway. And then we see Bud kind of sit down and smile and type. They knew this was a one-way trip, but I had to know. And now we see Lindsay completely break. She's crying, don't you dare leave me, Bud. And, you know, she's going to lose him. And Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio is fantastic. And then we cut to, you know, the aliens, the NTIs, come and take a look at Bud, take him by surprise, and we get our little 2001 coda. And, you know, Cameron was very conscious of this. He even says, you know, if I didn't think I could pull off an analog to 2001 underwater, I wouldn't be making the movie. You know, I don't think he pulls it off, but he, you know, he's drawing from the best, so he does okay. And we get an epic shot of this massive ship as this alien is leading Bud down into it. It reminded me, actually, of the ship in John Carpenter's The Thing, this is sort of the scope of it. And there are these really huge, coolly shaped towers at the edge of it that make it look like a little, you know, floating city. And it's beautiful. It's all phosphorescent and wonderful, wonderful design, very much like the aliens themselves. Then we get a sequence through the tunnel, which is, you know, would be like the Stargate, right? Then we get to this place where Bud is, and the aliens are able to control water to the point where they kind of part water in the tank, and they're on either side of him, and he's in the middle breathing air. And we get this one moment when he takes off his helmet, lets the water come out of his lungs, and actually breathes in the air. It's a big moment that he survived. Then, this movie, what's interesting here is there was a longer movie with a bigger plot that they kind of had to cut here. So, basically what Bud's, you know, says is, you know, what he's kind of speaking with them right through this sort of curtain of water. And they basically reproduce his last few messages to Lindsay, which is kind of why they want to help him. And then we cut away. We're now back in the surface ship, which has returned to the location because the storm is gone, and they're trying to figure out how to get the rig. We see Bud message both of them, you know, Virgil reporting, you know, reporting in. So he's still alive, and we get that one wonderful moment of relief, and where he says, have some new friends. You're going to love this. And suddenly on sonar, you know, the surface guys are like, something huge is coming up. So the ship, this massive alien ship, rises, and it takes basically the rig with it as it comes up, and it comes all the way up and crests the water and lifts all of these surface ships. There's a battleship and the rig mothership is all basically up on the top of this ship, and they creak a little bit, and we see them kind of being balanced there. And this massive alien ship rises to the surface. You know, incredible, incredible moment. In the extended edition, which is not the movie that I saw, but the extended edition, there's an extra plot twist that they put on, and that the aliens actually create these massive tidal waves that are going to hit every coastline in the world, because Bud has a longer conversation with them down there, saying, you're the one responsible for these tidal waves, why? And then the aliens show, you know, on the curtain of water, as if it was a screen, all the H-bomb tests and war and all that stuff, and the sense that they came and judged them. And then at some point, the aliens stop the tidal waves in mid-tidal wave, and there are these shots where, you know, sort of like a Roland Emmerich film, if you were, as it were. And because of Bud's sacrificing himself to come down and defuse the bomb and see the aliens, they realize that this is not a species beyond saving. And so the water recedes and whatever. So it goes really, and it's a little clunky. If you watch Extended Edition, it's a little much to have that extra thing in here. And I'm kind of glad that they sliced it down for the theatrical. At this point, it's a tight little movie with a lot of great tension. And I don't think you're going on wonder when you know, it's like first half Alien, second half 2001. Like, they don't mix. You know, you have enough wonder at the end with the ship coming up. I don't think you need to do the aliens, you know, didn't destroy the world, and that extra little layer of things, which I just didn't think was necessary. So I think the theatrical version, in my opinion, I like it better. I think it's tighter. And it you know, it's still a little clunky of an ending because it's a different film at the very end. But I think it works. I think it makes it. It makes the turn okay, as long as you don't have that extra plot that they left out, you know, which is kind of interesting. One little nit I have, of course, is that, okay, so the rig is now on top of the alien ship on the surface. And everyone inside the rig, they come out of the rig. And then they mention, we should be dead because of the pressure differential. Well, the aliens must have done something to us. But they wouldn't have known that the aliens would have done something to them. They would have never, ever come out of the rig. Ever, you know, like being pros that they are, they wouldn't have known that they wouldn't have died because it's possible that unless the pressure in the rig changed, but I don't think so. I think the rig was sort of self-contained in that, you know, the pressure at that depth, although, so I could be wrong. If the pressure in the rig itself went down to normal, whether they were inside of it or not, then that's the key. But it made me think of like, you know, if they were all socked in tight at this high pressure in the rig, why did they get out? But anyway, a nit on the ending. And then we have this moment where Bud comes out and Lindsay sees him and they run together and they hug and we have that, you know, that moment that works regardless of how many times you see it when you're at the end of a movie and it's a very satisfying scene, you know, and the hero and his friends, so on and so forth, are brought together and we're out. So, you know, just a brief summary. I really like The Abyss. I think it's one of Cameron's better films. I mean, it's very hard to differentiate in quality between Terminator and T2, me personally. I know a lot of people like T2 better than Terminator. I am not one of them. I prefer the first one. But from Terminator to T2, Cameron was just, he was knocking him out of the park every single time. Great camera work, great story, great performances, great ideas. He was like the science fiction film director for, you know, for about, you know, when the Terminator came out, I guess 82, somewhere about there, and The Abyss 89. And then, you know, he went into his mid-period, which he hit or miss for me. And then, you know, kind of came roaring back with Avatar. We'll continue to do things forward as well. I think he's going to do 4 more Avatar films. So we'll see. We'll see what he's got up his sleeve in the near future. But wonderful performances. I think, you know, the writing, very, you know, wonderful writing in that the relationship between Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Ed Harris is so the central part of the film. And it's a central part of the plot. And the two performers are so good. They're a match for each other. They have really great performers. They have great chemistry. And they're very into their roles. I mean, they're really into it. And you believe it. And you believe all the side characters. There's no real Hollywood characters for me in this film. I get drawn in by the realism of it. Like, it's not super realist, but it's authentic to me. All the characters feel authentic. The rig people. You know, compare the rig crew to, like, the crew from Prometheus. You know, just, if you want to, just flick through, like, a scene in Prometheus of the crew together and the scene here of this crew together. And you tell me what the difference is, you know. And also, I think this film was shot incredibly well. I think that it does not date from the 80s. I think he shot it in such a beautiful way. However, whatever film they used, however he framed shots, him and his DP, man, they killed. And I'm really looking forward to watching this in full-on Blu-ray, which I think is now slated to be released later this year. They're finally going to get it onto Blu-ray. And I think it's going to surprise a lot of people about how well and beautiful it looks still and how it doesn't date. So a little bit of trivia. I tried to salt in as much as I could into the film. But the moment when Ed Harris is swimming in that submersible liquid breathing suit, he almost drowned. So while he was filming a scene, you know, while he's holding his breath, at one point at the end of a cut, he was out of air, and the diver who was supposed to bring him air got hung up on some line that was ran, some cable, and he couldn't get free. So he was quickly running out of air, and he was starting to even take in a little water into his lungs. And some other diver came up and gave him his breather upside down, so it didn't fit into his mouth properly. So when he inhaled, he got half water and half air, and it happened one or two other times. And finally, one of the real safety divers came in and knocked the other guy's breather out of his hand. He gave him the real breather, and he was able to breathe, and they called it for a day. And Harris said, you know, at that moment, he really thought he was going to die. He was a little ashamed at how afraid he was, you know. Like, the making of, Harris is very candid, for the most part, about how he felt about it. You could tell that he was pretty unhappy with most of the shoot, and it was kind of plagued from the start. It was a really, really difficult shoot for him and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. You know, they had the most scenes. You know, just the rigor and the amount of hours they spent in the water over and over and over. And Cameron even says this is the most difficult shoot he ever had. You know, at one point, when they filled up this huge tank, there was this giant black tarp that was covering the sun, and it ripped and fell down at one point. So they had to get all like millions and millions of these small floating black balls to put on the surface of the water to block out the sun. They couldn't use a tarp on the surface because they had to, you know, actors at any point, anybody that was having trouble underwater, they had to be able to surface immediately. So, you know, think about a film shoot where you have all the crew and all these people around, and think about them if they were all underwater. You know, the director's underwater, the DP's underwater, the actors are underwater, the dialogue coaches, the people running the cameras, everyone's underwater and breathing apparatus and helmets. And, you know, so there were safety divers all over the place. So, imagine all the difficulties on a film shoot, plus you're underwater, you know, for like 10 hours a day. Where they had to decompress, actually, when they came up, because they were deep enough in this pool where they had to spend maybe 20 minutes or a half hour decompressing at certain depths so they didn't get nitrogen in the blood. So really interesting. But a very difficult shoot. And Harris said that night, you know, when he went home, he just cried that, you know, it was really, really traumatic experience. And very few scenes involve stunt people. When Bud drags Lindsay back to the rig, that's really Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. And they would have her without a helmet and her own air supply with Ed Harris, and then it would call action, and the diver with her air supply would swim away, and she would hold her breath, and he would drag her a certain length, and then they would roll cut, and the divers would come back and give her air again. You know, here she is, you know, several feet, 30, 40 feet down in this tank, no air supply, you know, of her own, and pretty intense. Even when the rig takes a hit, and you're seeing those scenes of the rig filling up with water, there are no stunt people. They're really actors moving through the water and tripping over each other and doing all that stuff, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. And the scene with the water tentacle actually was written in such a way that the whole thing could have been removed. And if you think about it, like they could have taken that whole scene out without it interfering with the story, and you could have just had Coffee just go crazy for some other reason. And because nobody knew how the effect was going to come out. This was so brand new. It was completely theoretical, and Cameron was, you know, wrote it in such a way that if Industrial Light and Magic didn't come up with something that he liked, he was just going to pull the thing out and not go with it, which was interesting. There's a, you know, Harris doesn't say this, and I don't hear from Cameron, but there is a sort of a rumor that on the day that Harris nearly drowned, I think Cameron said the wrong thing when he was recovering, and Harris punched him in the face, which is kind of interesting. The water in the tanks was chlorinated heavily to prevent microbes growing in it, and it caused any of the stunt people or people who didn't have to wear helmets, their hair would turn, would get bleached, so they had to kind of dye people's hair and then protect it in Vaseline, and then it would get bleached. And so as a last bit of trivia, Cameron declared this the worst production he was ever involved with, which was a sentiment shared by many of the cast members. They don't say as much in the documentary because, you know, they want to promote the movie and do the right thing, but off screen and off camera, you know, the difficulties of filming around and underwater put an immense strain on the cast and the crew, and, you know, complicated by Cameron's notorious perfectionism. So as difficult as things were, Cameron did not let up an inch in getting what he wanted. So many of them have been quoted as saying that they would never do a sequel or a movie like The Abyss again for Cameron. And for Cameron, a director known to often collaborate with the same cast and crew, the movie has suspiciously few people who worked with him again, including almost the entire cast, save for Michael Biehn, composer Alan Silvestri, and the director of photography, Mikhail Salomon. That's about all I've got to say about James Cameron, The Abyss. Hope you like the show, and see you next time.